Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you, as always, from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Yeah, and from the Stanford campus, they migrate to the air via the signals of this lovely station. And from the air, they migrate to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where John Perry has already posted a blog entry on the future of philosophy.
Such as it is. So, Ken, today we're not talking about philosophy per se. We're talking about philosophy and fiction.
Fiction.
Don't you like fiction?
I love fiction. Fiction is one of my favorite things to do, but to read and consume, and maybe even to create. But I got to tell you something. In some ways, I don't think of it as serious, you know? I mean, you can't really learn anything about the world, about yourself, about other people from fiction. It's all just make-believe. It can be pleasant, but that's about all there is to
it. You know, Plato wanted to banish the fiction writers from his republic, and you're reminding me a little bit of that. Prudish old philosopher Plato. In the first place, if fiction can help us pass the time in a pleasant way, it's great. It's not just kind of like a sad excuse for it. It's terrific. It puts it right up there with NFL football and other wonderful things, right? Secondly, you can learn a lot from fiction.
What?
You're wrong about that. There's a lot to learn from fiction.
Okay. I mean, you're saying two different things. You know, if it's a pleasant way to pass time, that puts it on the side, like, of a good meal. I mean, a good meal is a pleasant way to pass time. A pleasant conversation is a pleasant way to pass time. But that doesn't necessarily teach you anything deep. I mean, how is this pleasant way to pass time get you at deep truths about reality? I mean, we can get you at truths about make-believe. Well, what about reality?
Well, you're making one of those artificial bifurcations that philosophers make, Ken. I mean, a good conversation can also be something that's both pleasant and something also you learn from. And a good meal can be both pleasant to eat and nutritious. That's the difference between a good meal and a meal that's just flip-flop.
So there's nutritious fiction, you think?
Absolutely.
Tell me about that.
Take another one of my favorite novels, War and Peace. There you learn all about the invasion of Russia by Napoleon.
You learn all about one author's imagined characterization of the invasion and its significance. Again, though, it's make-believe. Have you learned anything deep about anything real? That's what I'm trying to get you to tell me.
Have you learned
anything about anything real from fiction?
Well, I mean, there's more reality in my world than you've dreamt of in yours or something like that. I mean, take the episode of Prince Andre with Napoleon in his sights. Now, you can see what it would be like to be a Russian nobleman, somebody with the personality characteristics of Henry Fonda, thinking about killing the most powerful man in Europe. I mean, where else are you going to learn what it's like to be inside the consciousness of somebody like that?
You plumb the depths of the imaginary consciousness of imaginary figures. That sounds like you do learn something. How deep it goes, we'll have to investigate. But, you know, let's see what some other people thought about fiction. Our roving philosophical reporter, Fani Inakadiz, went to the San Francisco Library and talked to lots of people about fiction. She files this report.
Does fiction teach us about the truth? Or does it just help us get away from it for a while?
I definitely think it's to escape reality. It seems like, I mean, you're living vicariously through your book, right? That's why people watch TV, because you live a more exciting life that way. And I would say that's totally the basis of why I and probably most of everybody reads science fiction or any kind of fiction, for that matter.
I'd say that there's definitely an amount of escape in it because, you know, if I have to be here, I might as well travel somewhere else through a book.
I think fiction's about life. I think fiction is fact.
I don't see it as an escape from reality because I see fiction is actually a dream of our future. If, for example, science fiction in many ways foretells our future. It's like, this is what can happen if we go this way, or this is what can happen if we go that way. For example, like in the 50s, we made a science fiction show like Star Trek with those handheld devices, which today we see very similar as those cell phones. So you see, I see fiction as our dreams and our aspirations and it where we can go with anything. So I don't see that as an escape.
Regardless of whether fiction is just an escape or leads to some kind of revelation about human truth, for some readers, certain works of fiction are very much alive. But how is it that these fictional characters, so removed from our own reality, and sometimes even our planet, can create such emotional empathy?
just the thought processes and emotions and things like that, the way that you get into that character's head, and you share this experience with them, and then that's how they feel relatable. Because you're like, that's how I might act, or I'd feel that way, or I felt that way. And so it kind of validates you, too, in your experience when you see somebody else having it. So, you know, sort of this attachment forms.
So what fictional characters have spoken to you?
Oh, definitely. Popeye. Yeah, it's like, I am what I am, and that's all that I am, because I'm Popeye the Sailor Man, and that's great philosophy. Just Popeye.
Wallace Stegner, Angle of Repose, I loved that book. It was wonderful, and I'm sure those people were real. They were alive. There was no doubt in my mind. And, you know, it's like, I learned more about that period of time, and I felt like I could go up to Nevada City and knock on the door. Except they were fiction. I'm pretty sure they were fiction. I'm not sure. Was it fiction? Yeah, okay. See, there you go. I wasn't sure. Yeah,
So how do you think that happens, that a fictional character is so real that you know, we keep this emotional connection or this amazing amount of fascination with a character that's not even really real?
It's in our mind. You know, we live with them, we read with them, we do all these things with them. They're in our mind, and they become real. It's magic.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Fani Avnakides.
Thank you, Fani, for that fascinating report about how people relate as strongly or more strongly to fictional characters than they do to real people. I'm Winnie the Pooh, and here with me on Philosophy Talk is Popeye.
No, that's Ken Taylor, and you're John Perry.
Oh,
and
I'm sorry.
Reality, folks. Yeah. This is reality. And we're joined today by Josh Landy, Associate Professor of French from Stanford University, author of a really fine book. It's called Philosophy as Fiction, Self-Deception and Knowledge in Proust. Josh, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks very much.
Josh, let me start with a question. Now, people like me can barely keep the facts of their own life straight. If we watch Jay Leno, we know that the average American doesn't know whether World War I came before or after World War II. And yet, some of those same people that Jay interviews could probably tell you Harry Potter's biography in great detail, and they could give you a complete history of Star Wars. Why is fiction so important to people, and isn't it crowding out the facts we need to know to live life the way we should?
Well, John, I don't mean to sound like an ungrateful guest. I'm very happy to be here, but I think you're both setting up the question the wrong way.
Well, tell us the right way to set it up. What do you mean by that?
Well, you seem to be assuming that either an engagement with fiction gives us some truth about the world, or it's maybe enjoyable but otherwise useless, like a nice meal.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Right. Professor of French, tell us how we should think of it.
Yeah.
Well,
I think that's a false dichotomy.
I think it's a false dichotomy, right? Yeah. So I think that there's a habit of appealing to the content of literary works, if you want to go somewhere to think about what the value of them is, and also a habit of looking to characters and thinking, well, you know, I could get inside the mind of that character, Prince Andrei. I could model myself on that character. But there are other ways of thinking about it, and I just want to quickly say two. One is think about the form of literary works and look to that as an inspirational model.
The form of literary works? You mean like chapter one, chapter two, that sort of thing?
That sort of thing.
Yeah, that's really inspiring, Josh.
Maybe tell me a little more filled in.
Okay, so we're gonna come back to what you mean, because you said there are two things. There's a form, and what was the other thing?
The other thing is the process. So there's something about the process of engagement with specifically literary texts that does something for us that a mere engagement with facts, not that there's anything wrong with engagement with facts.
I'm glad you added that.
Okay, but there's something else that goes on. There's some other kinds of mental activities that are in play.
So the process of reading a thing of this form or watching a thing of this form does something cool that you can't do any other way.
Right.
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 Tell me more about what that thing, what the form, and tell me
May
more
I
about
resort
that.
To an example?
By all means.
Okay.
By all means.
Sure. We do that a lot here.
Okay. So someone you may or may not have heard of, Plato. He has these things called dialogues.
Plato. Let me check my Wikipedia here. So
Okay. That's a guy we talk about a lot here.
Okay. So this is a much discussed topic, but let me try to say what I think briefly. The dialogues are not merely in dialogue form. So that is to say, they're not merely not treatises, right? So there's something literary about them, but they're also very ironic. And I think they're ironic partly because Socrates often messes up, produces really bad arguments that I think Plato has to know are bad arguments. And what happens when we as readers engage with these dialogues is that we're forced to do some work. We're forced to go in and correct the arguments. We're forced to dialogue, so to speak, with the dialogues.
Okay, so there's a sense, right, there's a reason he put him in dialogue form. He wants to interact with you in a certain kind of way. And philosophers and literary people go back and forth about why, you know, and philosophers don't write dialogue so much anymore, except my colleague John Perry does a lot, right? And there's a point to the dialogic form.
Right.
I got that, okay, but...
So there's something there about the process of our interaction that doesn't happen when we read Aristotle's more treatise-like.
Yeah, we don't fall asleep.
For example...
Right.
But what, I mean, what
is there something philosophically deep or cognitively deep about the...
Well, I don't know how deep you want it to be.
Well, I don't know, as deep as you want it to be.
But
I should point out that some people actually do fall asleep reading Plato, too. I mean, I've known such people.
They're just,
you've been like, such people.
I have a friend. I have a friend that falls asleep reading Plato.
But I'm gonna see how deep this goes. I mean...
So the idea here would be that what is of primary value for Plato is not a set of beliefs, but instead a method, right? So instead, what counts is living a certain kind of life, and that certain kind of life is indeed the life you guys live, which is the philosophical life. But in order to get there, it's not sufficient to have the right beliefs. You have to have a certain kind of method, and you can't learn that method by simply learning some facts.
Okay, I got you. So let's grant this. I certainly grant this point. Descartes has meditations, right? And people have pensées and all sorts of different forms. And there's a point to the form, a kind of cognitive point to the form. Okay, but let's just take the class of fictional works in general. You said John and I were setting up a false dichotomy. Either it's pleasant. I mean, you might think, well, the form makes it pleasant. It's fun to read things. One of the things that fiction does, I think of, is it offers invitations to imagine. So it doesn't just lay out a set of facts, but it invites you to engage in a kind of exercise. Imagine with me. In a certain way, and that's fun, right? That's cool.
Absolutely, and
I don't want to take away your pleasant meal. It's still got it on the pleasant meal.
Look,
right?
I'm not denying that it's fun.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that just because it's fun doesn't mean that it's otherwise useless or non-nutritive.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be nutritive only by virtue of giving us some truths about the world.
Okay.
So one of the things invites us to do is to imagine. But another thing that literary works typically invite us to do is to reconstruct them, is to go in and figure out how things are supposed to fit together, because they don't tend to give us everything at once.
So kind of like a crossword puzzle or something.
Exactly.
You're kind of depicting reading fiction from what sounds like a sort of academic professional point of view, kind of an aggressive looking at the form, trying to figure out how it's all supposed to fit together. Does this apply to the ordinary reader of a Harlequin novel too?
I was going to say yes to the ordinary reader, then you said Harlequin novel, so I don't know.
Because you don't think that's a very good
I think there are definitely some types of fiction that require more work.
Well, okay, take Harry Potter. That's pretty dense stuff, and it's bringing a lot of people into the world of readership, but are they doing this reconstructing and noticing the form that you're talking about?
I think that it's only going to be a question of degree. Yes, I think to some degree they are going to be doing that, because the work is going to give you hints and clues and suspense, and you're going to have to come back and you realize, oh, turned out that this is what this thing meant there. And there is some kind of active work that's required, that's indispensable to an appreciation even of a Harry Potter novel.
So here's one of the cool things you could get out of fiction. I mean, there's a kind of skill at reading fiction, as we've been talking about, and you can hone that skill to fine, you know, and some stuff can demand a really skilled exercise of this skill, a really virtuous exercise of this skill, and some can be less demanding. And you might think that the point or worth of fiction is like, you know, it's like learning to ice skate. It's like learning to exercise this skill. I mean, it's just fun to be able to ice skate really well, and it's fun to be able to read fiction really well. But I think it's more than just fun. I'm back to, does that fun get at something deep about life, about living? I mean, some of our people in Roving Philosophical Report said, you know, fiction is life. Was that real or was that imagined? I mean, you know, it's about us. It's about real, deep, and important stuff.
Let me interject here with something I heard on the news this morning. The new Microsoft PlayStation, whatever they call it, is coming out today, and there's a line of 200 or 300 people at Fry's in Palo Alto, and they interviewed some of them, and one of them said, yes, yes, this is really important. I mean, we're the same kind of people who line up for Star Wars and all that stuff. These people are living totally in a world of fiction and video games. Are they missing something?
Okay, so I now have two questions to answer.
You're clever. Go ahead.
What I want to say is basically that the world's are not the same. That is, the real world and the worlds of fiction are not the same, but they're analogous enough so that if I hone a skill in one world, I could deploy it in the other world. So it's not just like ice skating, where it's unlikely that I will need my ice skating skills in some real world, James Bond type scenario. But it's that the skills that I acquire through reading some certain types of text, I can use in my real life.
That makes me think, though. Let me suggest, see what you think about this suggestion. Okay, reading fiction it requires great skills of the imagination, skills of recognition, right? There's the good guys, there's the bad guys, skills of reasoning, all kinds of skills. These are skills for living. Reading fiction is a way of, and learning to read fiction well is a way of learning to live well. I mean, that would be a strong thing. That's more than just a pleasant meal.
Now we're agreeing.
Yeah, but I'm not sure I'm agreeing. Look, I mean, when you eat a pleasant meal, you learn manual dexterity. You have to handle your chopsticks, your knife, and your fork, and all that stuff. But that's really not the point. That's beside the point. The point is, it's fun to eat a good meal. Why does fiction have to offer us any more than that? It's an enjoyable read. Why isn't that the highest praise? What is all this malarkey? Is this just something you're inventing so that your profession of being kind of a literary kind of guy has some basis in improving our reality skills?
He's trying to get back at you for that remark about philosophy.
Yeah, I know. And I'm soon going to have to invoke his own writings, which are in the form of dialogues, if he's not careful.
But completely without literary merit. So I'm.
So you're completely safe. Yeah. Again, I don't mean to take away the fact that it's pleasurable and pleasure is a good. You know, even though some people don't recognize this as well, pleasure is a good. But I think that we have an intuition that at least certain literary works do something else for us. And it's very hard for a lot of people to put that into words, but we just have a vague intuition that something else is taking place. And I'm trying to put that into words.
So you're not so much making a point about what fiction has to be or its essence, but about maybe what makes the difference between really good, classic, worthwhile pieces of fiction and others that are merely enjoyable.
I think that's right.
I can buy that.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is the language of fiction. Our guest is Stanford University's Josh Landy.
We've been exploring the question of why people get involved with fictional worlds at all. In the next segment, we're going to explore what it means for a fictional narrative to be well-crafted. You can craft your own question and call us at 415-841-4134. That's real. That's true. 415-841-4134.
And we really will take your calls in a moment. Philosophy Talk will be right back. There's so much to be done. Count all the bees.
Chase all the clouds from the sky. Loggins and Messina, House at the Pooh Corners. You're not getting back to Pooh Corners. You're getting back to Philosophy Corner. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing the language of fiction. What is behind? How do you make a well-crafted work of fiction? Why do some works of fiction work so well on us and others don't? Join us. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, throughout the entire world, and also in the toon world, in the fictional worlds, you can call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Josh Landy from Stanford University. Josh, okay, some stories are really great. They work powerfully on your imagination. Some, apparently for you, Harlequin romance novels, don't work so well. I mean, what makes the difference? I mean, what's the secret of a well-crafted, powerful, fictional thing?
You're asking yet another huge question. But
well, this is philosophy talk. You know?
Man, we got
an hour. Come on.
We got a professor of French here. I mean, and one who believes in a distinction between truth and reality. This is a rare opportunity.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed to say it is rare. Okay, let me attempt to answer that by plagiarizing Aristotle.
I hope we don't fall asleep.
Yeah. Back from our...
But dialogically, a work of literature will be successful if everything in it is what it is and where it is for a reason. So you can't just get rid of something and have the work stay the same.
Yeah.
But I would add to that that it probably has to be high stakes. Maybe that's the difference between what we consider great literature.
When you say high stakes, what do you mean? I'm reading a novel or watching a play or watching a movie. What's at stake? I mean, I'm in the theater, I'm going to be gone in an hour, or I spend a week or a month with a novel and I go on with my life. What do you mean, high stakes?
Well, I suppose getting back to John's example of War and Peace, this is a work in which something major is at play. Why war? Why peace?
Yeah.
What does it take to be a good general? And so on. So probably we tend to value more highly those works that put issues in play that are important to us in some way.
But not necessarily important in the grand scheme of things. I mean, it could be just this individual little life and the tragedies of this individual. Can't you make great art out of this individual life and the tragedies that affect one woman in that inner city, addicted to drugs, trying to make her way? No great thing for the whole world, just this woman's life.
I'm not sure that the distinction is that neat, because I think that we tend to identify certain features in that individual life which have ramifications beyond just that story.
Well, let me give you an example. Almost everybody thinks that Nabokov's Lolita is a great book, but at first glance, it seems to take us inside the mind of a person most of us wouldn't approve of, wouldn't want to be, and wouldn't have thought we wanted to understand. How do you apply your criteria to that?
Oh, that's a beautifully difficult case. What do we gain from an experience of reading Lolita? I mean, to get back to my earlier point, I mean, I think it's one of the great novels for requiring extremely active engagement on the part of the reader. Another thing that you gain from it that's, again, somewhat hard to articulate is this creepy feeling that you are empathizing with a villain. And there's something very interesting about that, the uneasiness of getting inside the head of someone who is about as nasty as he could possibly be.
Now, earlier I suggested, and a lot of people have suggested, that part of the power of fiction, or part of what you learn from fiction, is seeing things from another person's perspective. But your last answer suggested actually maybe it's finding out about yourself and how you react to these imagined things that's even more important. Is that part of what you're trying to tell us?
Absolutely. Right, so that would be another reason. So it was something that Ken sort of slipped in his first remarks. There's a possibility that maybe you don't learn about the world, but you learn about your relation to the world. And that would itself be a sufficient reason for engaging with fiction.
Christopher in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Christopher. Christopher, are you there? I don't think so. Robin in San Mateo's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Robin.
Hello.
Is that you, Christopher?
No, this is Robin.
Okay, Robin. Okay, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Robin. Okay. Go ahead.
I have a question. If you read a cookbook, but you don't make the recipe, is that fiction then?
Well, that's a metaphysical question, yeah. Right? What if there's a recipe and nobody's ever followed it? Then is it a fictional recipe? Interesting.
Josh, you got anything to say about
that? I'd say no. I mean, I'd say that you distinguish fiction from nonfiction by what's being standardly prescribed to do with that text. So I'm standardly prescribed to learn how to make a recipe, even if I don't make the recipe, by reading the cookbook. I'm not being prescribed to imagine something that could never be taken to be actual.
I've got an email here. It's very interesting. It says, "Isn't fact just as open to twisting, altering, and subjectification as fiction? Thanks, Fox News." Oh, I'm sorry. It says, "Think, Fox News." And it's from Pete.
Look, I'm a member of a French department, so I should say yes, but I'm going to say no. You can interpret and you can present things in certain ways, you can select, you can order, and there are all these features of rhetoric. And yet there is, of course, a huge difference between fact and fiction, which is that there is something there that is true that is being represented, misrepresented, interpreted, misinterpreted, presented in a certain way.
I want to go back to the fiction contains a lot of bad guys and a lot of good guys, you know, works of fiction. And I guess we're supposed to sympathize with the good guys and revile the bad guys. That's, they're presented to us for revulsion or sympathy or something like that. But you said something that puzzles me a little bit a couple steps back. You said you agreed with me when I said skill at reading is skill at living, right? If exercised to a high degree. Does that mean if I'm just a good reader of fiction, I am ipso facto a better person, that reading fiction morally improves me necessarily? It sounds like you're committed to
it. Wait, you just moved from better to morally better.
I did, right?
Does that betray a certain commitment on your part?
Well, so you want to tell me more about why you're responding to
that? I think that we can live life better thanks to an engagement with fictions, and not merely an engagement with fictions, but fictions can aid us in a project of living life better. Does this mean morally better? No. That would be a massive restriction of what it means to live
better. So the goodness of good fiction, is it more like the goodness of having lots of good meals in your life than the goodness of morally improving the world? I mean, we had a show a while back on moral saints, and Susan Wolfe, our guest back then, said she doesn't want to be a moral saint because a moral saint has to forego all the non-moral goods. So are you putting fiction in the realm of one of the non... It's not immoral. It's just not a moral good. It's just a different kind of good.
Well, I'm...
Like fine symphonies.
What I'm saying is it's instrumental to goods which are not just moral goods.
Right. So let's say I read Mickey Spillane novels and I fall in love with Mike Hammer. Well, not really. I just think he's a very interesting guy. I guess I'm learning certain life skills. I mean, I might talk better with a hard-boiled detective if I ever meet one. I'm certainly not a morally better person, but you think I'm better in some way. Of course, maybe you don't think those are really such great novels. I don't know.
Okay. All right. So first of all, yes, you'd have to engage with certain kinds of fiction. Secondly, you'd have to engage in the right way. Right? I see fictional works as training grounds, but they're just grounds. I mean, it's like if you go to the gym and you don't lift the weights, it's not the fault of the weights that you don't gain muscle. So similarly, you have to pick your artwork, and then you have to engage with it in the right kind of way. And at that point, yes, then maybe you'll hone certain skills that are actually useful in your life. Okay. Are they skills of being able to talk like a hardball detective? No.
I think we're
not talking about that kind of
stuff. I think we're going to have to pick up on this. I think there's a lot more to say about this. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the language of fiction with Stanford's Josh Landy. What do you think is the purpose of fiction? What have you gotten out of it?
Should there always be a moral to a story? The facts about fiction and more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. Clothes you are mussing. What a clothes much ado about nothing. Brush up your Shakespeare and they'll all bow, bow. From Kiss Me, Kate, Brush Up Your Shakespeare, making a point about the value of reading fiction that we haven't considered, namely it'll help you get women. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, or men, or whatever you want. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the language of fiction. Should fiction have a place in determining our morals? Can it morally shape us? Tell us what you think. Join us. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or finally, you can email us comments@philosophytalk.org.
Josh, I want to challenge you on something. I think fiction has more moral significance than you're giving it. I don't think it's just about exercising a non-morally significant skill. Because what is it the skill at reading fiction is? It's a skill at responding to representations of other people and their suffering and their hopes and their aspirations. It's a skill at judging people and evaluating people. So I don't know. I think it's deeply moral. And we've got a caller in the line who I think wants to make the same point. Sheila in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sheila.
Hello. Actually, my point was slightly different.
Well, it's related, though, I think.
Yeah. Well, I was. First of all, I want to say that this is the first time I've been moved to ever call a call-in talk show because, you know, there hasn't been one mention of an argument that's been put to me since I was, you know, a kid, which is that reading makes us smarter in ways that have nothing to do with ingesting facts.
Well, Sheila, I hope it's a good sign that you were moved to call us, but continue with your point.
Well, I mean, because the way, I mean, your guess was correct in saying that the way the argument was framed was a false dichotomy. I mean, when we read fiction, we are being stimulated. Our brain synapses are firing, and much more than with other forms of more passive entertainment like television. And I think they've shown that, you know, that kind of brain activity can keep our brains healthy way into old age.
So you're thinking of fiction as like good exercise for the brain. But I'm trying to press, John, I don't know if you agree or disagree, that it's good moral exercise for the self. It's not just, you know, it's not like doing gymnastics. It's like exercising one's moral sense.
Thanks for the call, Sheila. Really good point.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's good exercise, but is it good moral exercise?
Well, first let me say I completely agree with the caller that I think it is good exercise, punct. Is it good moral exercise? I think it's going to depend massively, first, on the type of work you engage with, and second, on the type of engagement that you have with it. I think that, as I was saying earlier, that, you know, typically the works we value the most are high-stakes works. So they often engage questions that could be thought of as moral. Does that mean that's going to make us better moral agents? Not necessarily. What it may very well do is to clarify us as to what our moral principles actually are. But people usually think they convert us, right? So if they do moral work, the moral work that they do is they make us better.
Well, there's this... I'm not sure people usually think that. I mean, it's a complicated thing. So fiction, there's lots of morals in fictions, and we're supposed to buy the moral of the story, I take it often. But there is this phenomenon that philosophers call imaginative resistance, where we won't go where fiction sometimes invites us to go because it goes so against our own moral sense. So, yes. I mean, what do you think of that?
I think it's an interesting view. I think it's a very problematic view. Take one example. You're watching mummy movies. In mummy movies, there's always a character whose sole function it is to say there's no such thing as mummies, and then to get killed by a mummy.
Yeah, right.
and we think this is great because he's an idiot and he deserves to die, which is a very curious point because in real life, presumably, if somebody said to us there's no such thing as mummies, and another person said, of course, you know, we should keep an open mind, there are mummies, probably if we wanted one person to die, it wouldn't be the one who's the rational one, giving reasons, appealing to evidence. So what happens in our engagement with works of fiction, we become very strange people, and we start having schemes of values that are very different from our normal schemes of values.
I suppose Nabokov was maybe pushing that point with Lolita, showing us that he can lead us places we might have told him he couldn't.
Richard in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Richard. Are you there, Richard?
You've got a little bit down to the level that I wanted to talk about fiction, because fiction to me is not just French and Russian novels. It's stories that grandmothers tell you. And they have very specific morals, and they're used to help you grow.
And that's, do you want to add to that? You think our guests can't quite accommodate that? Is that your worry?
No, I think that should be included in the discussion. And the discussion's been moving pretty quickly. You're now talking about moral values that come from fiction, and it's fiction that we're brought up on that has the most impact, I believe.
Thanks, Richard.
Yeah, that's a good point, Richard. And one of our emailers says something similar. He says that, you know, Tolstoy can very well have as much value, have as much to say about human nature and our world as Plato, but, you know, that old philosopher Jesus knew that, and the parables are just short stories we're expected to learn from, probably some of the same ones your grandmother told you. So what do you have to say about grandmothers and Jesus?
Okay. Well, look, I love the point about the grandmother stories. I think that the caller is absolutely right, that these are the first stories that we hear. The one thing I want to say about that is that they come with the sanction of an external authority. So the grandmother's helping you to understand what you're supposed to gain from the story, which means I think that it's a little tricky to say that the moral comes directly from the story itself, so that it would work without the external interpretation. The parables is a really interesting case because these parables are supposed to people think they're supposed just to work on us. We understand what the moral of the story is. But if you actually read them in their context, the New Testament, you see that not even the disciples understood what Jesus was saying with the parables.
Right.
So they actually they're a fascinating genre in which somehow the point of them does not have to do with the clear transmission of a moral message.
Wait. Okay. I understand that, but I still, I don't know. Even if there's not a message that comes at the end, in this process that you were talking about, what are we to imagine? We don't typically. I mean, we could tell stories that are morally neutral in their content, but the exercise of imagining is an exercise often of imagining a moral order, maybe an order different from our own, maybe an order that stretches us, maybe an order that threatens us. But it's suffused with this high-stakes moral stuff. And that exercise, that workout, I think it can improve that power that you have to judge the world, and not only to judge the world, but to guide your own life. I mean, and it seems to me not accidental to fiction, but kind of intrinsic to it, that it offers you up stuff for the moral evaluating.
I think that that way of phrasing it is actually pretty close to the way that I think about it. What I'm resisting is the idea that there's one right way of living. That right way of living is strictly moral, not just broadly ethical, and that fiction drags us bodily, kicking and screaming, whether we like it or not, over into that good and true way of seeing the world.
Brian's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Brian in San Francisco.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for your topic. I just wanted to mention some fictional books that were fiction or fantasy that, you know, influenced me. You know, I grew up reading Tarzan and Huckleberry Finn and imagining different worlds like that. But when I became a teenager, I started reading George Orwell. I read Animal Farm and 1984. Those certainly influenced my, you know, political understanding. I read Johnny Got His Gun by Jalton Trumbo, and that influenced my political philosophy towards war. And then later on in life, watching television, I think the entire country was influenced by Star Trek in envisioning a world that was in the future that was multiracial and a world without poverty. And so I'm a big fan of science fiction, particularly Arthur C. Clarke, who a lot of people are actually building one of the things that he envisioned, which is called the space elevator. They just had a symposium on it down in Mountain View in NASA.
Brian, fiction's played a big role in your life. Do you think you've been awfully lucky in the novels that influenced you? I mean, suppose you'd, read mostly stuff by Leon Uris and had become a Marine, and you would have led a much different kind of life. Who was responsible for giving you these novels?
I guess it was my father. My father, you know, was not a pacifist. He had been in war. He was a member of the War Resisters League, and he actually gave me these books, 1984, Animal Farm, and Johnny Got His Gun.
Yeah, so you read Johnny Got His Gun instead of Battle Cry, and that makes a big difference.
Thanks, Brian. So what do you think, Josh? I mean, how do you respond to that whole exchange there?
There's a lot of stuff in here. I mean, for one thing, I think that one of the reasons why 1984 is as powerful as it is because it has the treatise. And so it's an interesting hybrid form, which I'm not sure would do the kind of work it does without that. But maybe a bigger point, which picks up on what John was saying, look, there are fictions that seem to depart from this particular moral perspective, and then there are fictions that seem to depart from the opposite moral perspective. We're going to be bombarded with all kinds of fictions, and maybe it'll be better for us, all things considered, not to be too malleable. Because if I make up my mind about my moral values on the basis of fictions, well, that's not a very principled way of going about things.
I agree about that in a way, but in another way I don't, because I think you have to think of fiction as in dialectical engagement with everything else that engages the imagination. All kinds of things engage the imagination. All kinds of things push and pull and stretch and bend. And fiction is one source, and I think an important source and kind of an institutionalized source. And maybe we don't argue enough with one another about things of you know, imagine enough over the coffee table and stuff like that. But you think of fiction as just occupying one kind of dialectical place in the total space of things that push and pull the imagination. But it has this great capacity through artistic undertakings and through the presentation of beauty, right, to like engage the imagination. I do think there, I guess I disagree with you about one thing. I do think there is a phenomenon of imaginative resistance. There is a phenomenon there, but it's oversold, right? And but so I don't know. So if you think of fiction as one pusher and puller of the imagination among others, then you're free to adopt in an episode of imagining whatever moral perspective. Then you're going to come back to reality. You're going to come back to all the other things that
I think you're disagreeing with yourself. I agree with the last thing you said, which is you're completely free to engage in the imagining that's prescribed to you by such and such a novel or film or so on. And then you come back. This is very different from the imaginative resistance picture, in which you can't really get in there by shedding your standard presuppositions about a moral framework. I think that is what happens. You get in there and you're not quite yourself when you're engaged with a fictional world. You're imaginatively adopting its values, not merely adopting the set of facts that...
I don't think you adopt them full bore. I mean, because you still retain some kind of distance between the imagined. But let's some more callers in there. Ruhama in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ruhama.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually write fiction as well as thinking about philosophy. And I think something that's being missed is that fiction's about human beings. And the way it works is by engaging the reader with these people who, fiction isn't just anything that isn't true. I mean, they're real human beings who might be acting in an imaginary story or in an imagined world. And by empathizing with those characters, the reader has the potential to expand their compassion, which is a moral value, at least to some people. So even a book like Lolita, or there are characters in War and Peace that aren't very nice either, but it's not so literal that you just say, oh, I'm going to be like the good guys in this book. I'm not going to be like the bad guys in this book. It's more that you see the reflection of all human qualities in the characters, and you see those qualities in yourself, and then you, first of all, have compassion for people, and secondly, you're in a better position, a more objective position, to make moral choices for yourself.
Ruhama, thanks for the call. Yeah, she seems to be saying, and I think maybe rightly, that fiction has a unique power to expand your compassion. So it's a unique kind of vehicle, and so intrinsically morally significant in a way.
And this is similar to a position that Richard Rorty has pushed, according to which that is the value, one of the two main values of fiction. The problem here, I think it's going to end up being necessary but not sufficient, right? So we need to have the capacity, if we want to be full moral agents, we need to have the capacity to get inside the minds of other people, understand what their suffering is, and this kind of thing. But if I want to be a really efficient torturer, I'm going to need exactly the same skill. So there's no guarantee that an increase in my skill of knowing what it is that makes somebody hurt will make me more compassionate towards them.
Yeah, I think that's right. Erica in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Erica.
Hi, I'm also a writer and of fiction, novels, and short stories. And I think it's really essential to point out that, in essence, philosophy and fiction are the same thing. And a lot of writers start with a philosophical idea, and they illustrate it and explore it with fiction. And I also think it's important to point out that there are different purposes of fiction. It's not just, I mean, some people write moral fiction, and I personally don't really find that to my taste. I write other kinds of fiction, and sometimes the purpose is for fluff, for fun, and other times it's life-changing, and people really do take deep lessons from it, and they change the way they think and the way they behave.
Thanks, Erica. Nice call. I think you believe one thing she said, because you wrote a book called Philosophy as Fiction. So. But what's your...
I believe a lot of the things that she said.
Yeah, this will probably be our last one with you.
I believe, yes, absolutely, there are different functions, and this is why, you know, it's a short show. So we tried to capture, I guess, a couple of the functions. And yes, I do believe at least some philosophy is intimately related to fiction, has a fictional, literary components at least. Some fiction has a heavy dose of philosophy. what happens when people get changed as a result of reading fictions, watching movies? Well, people, I think, like to say that they are changed by the fiction. I think it may well be the case that the fiction catalyzes some kind of process of reflection, which ends up in the reader or viewer taking a certain position at the end of it. That's a bit different from saying the fiction had a moral, it taught me a lesson. It's a different way of thinking about it, and I think it's an important difference.
So, Josh, on that note, it was really fun having you on the show. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Josh. Our guest has been Joshua Landy, Associate Professor of French in the Department of French and Italian at Stanford University and the author of Philosophy as Fiction, Self-Deception, and Knowledge in Proust.
We also want to thank all the callers. There were a whole lot of callers and emailers we didn't get a chance to talk to. So, John, are you... I guess we can learn things from fiction. We start out wondering whether you can learn anything from fiction, and now we know there's a lot you can learn.
Well, I think one of the greatest things about fiction is that it allows us to do the philosophy of fiction.
Yeah.
And gives literary critics something to think about. There's all these important manifestations of different human genomes that would be wasted without fiction.
Yeah.
Not just the writers and the readers, but the people that just love to think about what's it all about.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess I was only pretending when I said at the top of the show.
It was just a fiction.
It was just a fiction.
Conceit.
It was just a pose. Because I think fiction is really one of the most important things. One of my favorite philosophers, Frege, had this crazy theory of fiction that it was a second grade kind of thing. It was like when you were serious, you did logic, you did mathematics, you did philosophy. You didn't do fiction when you were serious about the world. But I think you do fiction when you're deeply serious.
So,
when you're deeply serious about imagining ways the world can be in some kind of rich detail. And when those imaginings are... produce beauty, you know? I mean, that's deeply serious stuff.
So Ken, if you had your choice between erasing from the human... you had to do one or the other. Erase from the human consciousness the five deepest theorems of mathematics or the five greatest works of fiction. Which would you choose?
I would do like Josh Landy, our guest, did when he first came on. I would say the choice is ill-posed. You're creating a false dilemma. And if you're God, I want out of your universe. I want in a universe where I don't have to make that choice. That's what I'd say.
I'd say, well, I have no idea what the five deepest theorems in mathematics are. I don't know what I would say.
Anyway, this conversation goes on, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. So go check it out.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earl.
Special thanks to Rujin Shen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.